This is Srinivas Rao, the host of the Vistage podcast series, and today I'm speaking with Patrick Ungashik. Patrick leads several companies that provide financial consulting and advisory services and products. His companies help business owners build companies that they can happily exit from, advise investment committees of mid-sized retirement plans how to create successful participant outcomes, and help consumer investors reduce risk and achieve personal financial goals. Patrick, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So I want to ask you the very first thing that is on my list, and that is, what's the most important thing that business owners fail to consider when planning for business succession or perpetuation?
It's a great question. Obviously, it's one of the big ones. And the short answer is, too many CEOs and owners of privately held companies confuse growth with value, and they fail to understand that in most situations, to have a successful exit, there needs to be value within the company, and value that transfers to the outside buyer or to the successor. By successor, I mean a child is going to take over the business if that's the situation, or a key employee is going to take over the business if that is the situation. Lots of companies are successful in growing. Lots of Vistage-led companies enjoy sustained periods of just great growth, top-line growth, bottom-line growth. But you can have a business that's growing in size, again, either measured on the top line or bottom line or some other financial metric. You can have a company that's growing in size, but not necessarily getting more valuable, especially the value that transfers an exit. So for example, a simple but common example might be is that the owner, CEO of that business has most of the key customer relationships in their pocket. When that's the case, then if and when that owner exits, well, then those key customer relationships are at risk. And the outside buyer or the successor might say, wait a minute, when you leave, a lot of the value leaves with you. Another example where a company might be doing a phenomenal job in growing, but the value is not there, is if there's a high degree of customer concentration. An outside buyer or a successor might say, yeah, I see the company's bottom line is healthy and growing, et cetera. But you've got this customer concentration, and that's a real problem for me. I can't capture that value going forward. Mm-hmm. And so there are different characteristics of a business that influence its value that are unrelated to its growth. And the big mistake that too many CEOs make is they believe that they're doing all the right things to get to a successful exit because they're making decisions today that are almost exclusively run through the filter of, is this the right thing to do to grow my business, whereas that decision may or may not be the right thing to build value within the business.
Mm-hmm. What are some key metrics when it comes to measuring value that business owners can focus on? Because one of the things I've seen often is that people get caught up in measuring all the wrong things.
You're right, and it's a struggle because with a privately held company, you don't have the benefit of a stock ticker tape scrolling by, knowing whether or not your share price is getting bigger that day or that minute. And so in a privately held company, value is abstract, and it's definitely not top of mind. Metrics that are commonly used are typically growth-oriented. You know, my top line, my bottom line, my trailing 12 months, my this quarter, this year, over the same quarter last year. Those are typically almost entirely growth metrics. Some value metrics are a little bit harder to get your arms around, and they can often be industry or situational specific. But some examples of value metrics might be my customer diversification, my repeat business with my customers, the performance of my top people, because nearly every company's most valuable asset is its top people. The intellectual property within the company and any sort of financial metrics regarding its value in the marketplace. So you're right, it's a key question, and it's one that's harder to get around.
Mm-hmm. How many years in advance should an owner plan his or her exit strategy?
A lot earlier than most owners think. You know, the conventional wisdom on this out there is that you can be a successful business owner, CEO, put your head down, spend 5, 10, 20, maybe even more years growing that business. There's that growth thing again. And then the conventional wisdom says somewhere within the last 1 to 3 years is the most common understanding most people have. You kind of get ready for exit. You clean up the balance sheet, and you literally will hear people say you put a fresh coat of paint on the walls in the office and spruce things up and get ready. Well, that's just too little too late. That's not exit planning. That's scrambling. That's reacting. We typically are pointing out to people that if you've got anything less than 10 years between now and your ideal exit date or your ideal exit age, And what's already happening with 10 years or less, what's already happening is some decisions are being moved from the column of things that I can influence, and they're being moved over into the column of things that I cannot influence. For example, there's a lot of tax structures with privately held businesses that need as much as 10 years in order to put in place the ideal tax structure if I'm going to sell my business, for example. If I'm going to give my business to the kids, many of the tax strategies that involve tax-free transfers of a valuable business to the kids take years to effect. If I'm going to build my IP portfolio, or if I'm going to develop the most effective management team and leadership team, those are the types of activities that have value that I can't do within 12 months or 24 months or even maybe 36 months. So a lot of that value creation happens much earlier in the process. Anything 10 years or less, and that business owner / CEO is already beginning to lose control over pieces of the outcome and is already in the homeward stretch. Mm-hmm.
In the context of that, one question I have, any thoughts on situations like the acquisition of Instagram by Facebook, which happened in absolutely record time and is definitely an anomaly, but I'd be curious to hear your perspective on something like that, especially because it goes so counter to what you just said.
It does. And, you know, those outliers exist. They tend to exist in the world of publicly traded companies where the systems and the markets add a degree of efficiency into the process that doesn't exist in the world of privately held companies. And, you know, there are probably situations that happen all the time where a privately held company is bought or sold, depending upon your side of the transaction, relatively quickly, relatively pain-free, you know, with relatively little complications and top value. It happens. But that's not the norm. Mm-hmm. If you get 10 or 100 CEOs of privately held companies a room and say, you know, what are your impressions about what it takes to sell a business, you get pretty strong consensus, if not borderline unanimity, that they go, this is hard and this is stressful on the individuals, it's stressful on the organization, the taxes can be a nightmare, you know, the hours that are required in order to effect a positive exit can be overwhelming. So, I mean, there are those success stories, and unfortunately there are the disaster stories as well. Mm-hmm. For the vast majority of situations in the middle, it's stressful and difficult. And even if there's a happy exit on the end, most people would prefer not to have to go through some of the things that they have to go through to get there.
Right. Well, that actually makes a perfect transition to my next question, which is, how do you include long-term employees as part of an exit strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a topic that a lot of people, I think it's kind of 180 degrees counterproductive view. And what I mean by that is, too often the owner and CEO is very sensitive, overly sensitive to issues of confidentiality. And I get why, because often this question comes up with the perception that, well, wait a minute, if I'm going to sell my business next Thursday, do I want my key employees to know? And if you've never had any conversations with the key employees at all on any level and you're thinking about selling next Thursday, yeah, that would definitely be a disturbing conversation to have with people. And, of course, you always have the concerns in about your competition, et cetera. We look at this a little bit differently. We think that we've seen that there's just great opportunities when owners sit down with top employee talent years in advance. It goes back to that, you know, you have 10 years or less, your to-do list is getting longer. But imagine a scenario and the types of scenarios we want to see and create where owners are sitting down with top employees 5 years before the owner thinks they might be exiting, 10 years before the owner thinks that he or she might be exiting, and saying something along the lines of the following, you know, key employee Bob, key employee Mary, you're dynamite. You're a key member of this organization. And you know what? I'm not going to do this forever, just like I don't expect you to work forever. One day this company might be sold. You know, when that can happen is not known. There's no guarantees. And how is not known. There's no guarantees. But when that does happen, I want there to be some real financial rewards for you in this. And I'm willing to put some promises on the table that says, if you're here 5 years from now, 10 years from now, whenever this happens, we're going to create some real economic rewards for you in reward for you staying here and helping grow the company from a financial result and from a value result between now and then. If you leave, then guess what? You're going to forfeit all that. So we call those programs golden handcuffs, stay bonuses, STAY. They have all the stock appreciation rights. They have all different ways to get that done. But the bottom line is there's a phenomenal opportunity for owners and key employees to take an issue that seems such, you know, so such prone for danger and turn it into a real advantage to create alignment between those owners and those key employees and create this mutual opportunity for shared reward down the road, remove the stigma, remove the stress of the unknown, and say, hey, when this happens, because we hope it's going to happen one day, it's a financial win for everybody. Mm-hmm. Those are the situations where the key employees are highly motivated to do good and right by everybody. Those are some phenomenal win-win.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you one final question, which is, what are the key elements of a buy-sell agreement and valuation, et cetera?
Great question. Buy-sell agreements are one of the most important risk management tools as part of an exit plan. You know, if an owner is thinking in the way we describe right about this topic, they're beginning to think about it, 10 years out, 5 years out at a minimum. And anything can happen in 5-10 years. And so a buy-sell agreement is one of the most common tools in order to say, well, what if I get the curveball, if life throws me a curveball along the way, here's how we're going to be prepared for it. I'll tell you right out that the number one mistake most people have regarding buy-sell agreements is most companies of definitely vintage size and vintage profile will have these agreements in place. The number one mistake they'll make is they'll put the agreement in place and it gets put into a digital or a literal filing cabinet, and then it doesn't get looked at for 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, sometimes even longer. And so much changes so quickly inside the small to medium-sized business that they get 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road, and there is a triggering event, and that buy-sell agreement gets pulled out, and they blow the dust off of it digitally or literally, and they go, oh, no, I can't believe the agreement still says this. And then that's even sometimes even worse than having no agreement at all. So some of the key provisions, without a doubt, are valuation method. How are the parties involved going to agree to set a value on this company? Are you going to name a specific price? The company's worth $10 million. Are you going to use a formula? If so, what formula should you use? What's the best approach to do that? There's no right or wrong answer, but it definitely should be done intentionally. Then another series of issues that come from there is who's buying who out upon what triggering event. Everybody tends to gravitate right away towards the scenario of a shareholder or an owner dying, and that can happen, of course, and as tragic as it is, that's an obvious example of where a buy-sell agreement is needed. But thankfully, death isn't very common. And some of the other scenarios that statistically are more likely to happen are often woefully under-addressed in the buy-sell agreement. Scenarios like, what happens if there's a shareholder dispute? You know, the two or more co-owners just decide they don't want to be co-owners anymore. What happens if an owner gets very sick but doesn't die or goes through a divorce and then the underlying value of the risk is the underlying value of the business is at risk of being pulled into the courtroom. So some of the key provisions are, how are you going to put a value on the business? What are the key triggering events that would bring the buy-sell agreement out and make it the governing document? And then key questions is, what's the funding mechanism going to be? You know, if someone dies, typically there's some amount of insurance, and that certainly can be a help. But some of these other scenarios I mentioned, like a shareholder dispute or a divorce happening with one owner, there's no insurance to cover scenarios like that, at least not that I know of. And so then you have some real funding demands and some real funding questions. So buy-sell agreements are a critically important document and one that too often are not paid enough attention to and not as comprehensive as they should be.
Well, Patrick, thanks so much for taking some time to join us and sharing your insights with the Vistage listeners. Can you tell us a little bit about where they could find you online?
Sure. Well, there's a number of resources they have online. The name of our consulting company is White Horse Advisors, so they can go to whitehorseadvisors.com. We actually have a channel on YouTube called Exit Planning Tools, where there's some content on YouTube. And then we also have a website that has some of our diagnostic tools and assessment tools that have been popular with Vistage members. That's available at businessexitplanningtools.com.
Well, until next time, good luck with your business.